Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter arrived in Iraq Saturday to meet with coalition commanders to review and assess the operation to retake Mosul from Islamic State militants. Carter's unannounced visit to Baghdad comes after an American soldier was killed in the region a few days ago. The defense secretary is also scheduled to meet with Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi. They are likely to discuss Baghdad's reluctance to include Turkish forces in the Mosul operation. Turkey wants to have a larger role in the battle for Iraq's second city, which has been under Islamic State control for more than 2 years. But the Iraqi government is opposed to Turkish military involvement in Mosul.
Anything that the counter-ISIL coalition does in Iraq will have to be with the approval of the government of Iraq. That's a principle that we and Turkey share, the integrity of the Iraqi state. But I'm confident that we can work things out and that there are things that would be very productive for Turkey to do. And we just need to work through those practicalities.
The United Nations and officials from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons say the Syrian government is responsible for a third chemical attack that affected a region already torn by war. The group's fourth report during a 13-month investigation sent to the UN Security Council late Friday blames President Bashar al-Assad's government for using several barrel bombs containing chlorine gas dropped by military helicopters. A U.S. Navy warship has passed through waters claimed by China near disputed islands in the South China Sea to counter what Washington says is Beijing's attempt to limit freedom of navigation. China condemned the action late Friday, calling it a provocation and a gravely illegal act. This is VOA News. Faced with disappointing polling numbers in less than 3 weeks to bridge the gap, Donald Trump on Friday stayed upbeat as he campaigned in two key battleground states.
Either we win this election or we lose the country. And believe me, this is the last time we are going to have a chance to win. This is it, folks. This is it.
Trump highlighted three recent polls showing him ahead of his rival, Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton, who campaigned Friday in the hotly contested state of Ohio. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte is walking back from a statement made this week in China that he planned to break ties from the United States. On Saturday, Duterte said that severing ties with the U.S. would not be in the best interest of his people.
It's not severance of ties. When you say severance of ties, you cut the diplomatic relations. I cannot do that. Why? It's to the best interest of my country that we maintain that relationship. Why? Because there are many Filipinos in the United States of, well, Americans of Filipino ancestry.
Duterte said the separation from the U.S. meant a departure from a foreign policy. The Filipino leader said until he became president, his country always followed what the United States said. 11 hours after a cyber attack first hit the United States Friday, the internet company DEN said the issue had been resolved. Those disruptions began in the United States, then spread into other parts of Western Europe, and caused an internet outage that affected several popular websites, including the social network Twitter. The U.S. government is investigating who's responsible for that cyber attack. The Russian national man accused by American officials of hijacking U.S. targets and arrested earlier this month in the Czech capital was indicted by a federal grand jury in the U.S. state of California. On an October 5th official Prague page, it noted that he remains in custody and is awaiting an extradition hearing. The Russian embassy in Prague is said to be working with Czech authorities to prevent his extradition to the United States. The Iraqi army says the 9th Division has pushed into a town southeast of the Islamic State-held city of Mosul and raised the Iraqi flag over a government compound in the town center. The army claimed to have taken the town of Humdaniyah on Saturday, but was likely still facing pockets of resistance in and around the town. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The Democratic Alliance is disgusted at this decision. We think it sends out an entirely incorrect message around our commitment to human rights.
A major South African opposition party plans to legally challenge the government's decision to withdraw from the International Criminal Court.
I'm very fine. I'm told by the doctors that my heart, everything else, kidneys, whatever, is about to go over a 30-year-old.
Malawian President Peter Mutharika denies speculations he's ailing.
I am running for president because I know that I am that leader. And my track record is really acting in the best interest all the time of my nation.
And a former Ghanaian first lady says she has experience and fortitude to become the next president of the republic. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A major South African opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, or DA, plans to petition the Constitutional Court Monday to challenge the government's decision to withdraw membership to the Hague-based International Criminal Court, or ICC. On Friday, South Africa officially notified the United Nations that it wants to withdraw from the ICC. But parliamentarian James Self, a leading member of the DA's legal affairs group, told me the government constitutionally erred in its approach to the United Nations before seeking approval from the South African parliament.
Well, the Democratic Alliance is disgusted at this decision. We think it sends out an entirely incorrect message around our commitment to human rights and our abhorrence of human rights abuses and of genocide. And we believe it has set back our foreign policy and the way in which South Africa is viewed in a very fundamental way. We also believe that the decision itself has been taken in a way which is unconstitutional, unlawful, and unprocedural. And accordingly, we will be lodging papers in the Constitutional Court on Monday morning, seeking the court's ruling that it reviews and sets aside this decision by the South African government.
The Attorney General says the government will be tabling a motion before Parliament come next week. You think the process and thereby making the moves in Parliament to take it through the normal governmental procedures to withdraw is illegal still?
Yes. Well, you cannot inform the Secretary General of the United Nations that you are withdrawing before you've consulted the South African Parliament, who has ratified the treaty. That's putting the cart before the horse. You first consult the South African Parliament, you get the Parliament's approval, and then you communicate with the Secretary General. But we all know why this is so. The South African government wants to come to Parliament with a fait accompli and say that that unless we as members of Parliament support that motion, we will be embarrassing the South African government in its dealings with the United Nations.
The argument or the contention by some leaders on the African continent, for that matter, some Africans, is that the ICC seems to only target majority of the time African countries, including President Bashir until recently, then the former vice president of DR Congo, Pierre Bemba, who has been prosecuted successfully at the ICC, and that the ICC only target African leaders majority of the time. So there was need to withdraw membership, just like in some Western countries who have done so and are not signatory to the ICC.
Well, to the extent that the ICC is or may be perceived to be less than completely consistent, that needs to be addressed. For example, there are terrible human rights abuses that are occurring in Syria at the moment. There are many other parts of the world that are also characterized by human rights abuses. But that the correct response is to say, well, let's take action against people responsible for human rights abuses in Syria. That does not absolve the African continent for observing human rights itself. And I'm afraid to say that on the African continent, there have been a number of particularly egregious examples of human rights abuses and even genocide, which need to be dealt with by a competent court because they are crimes against humanity. And unless the international community stands up against those crimes, all that South Africa and the African Union is doing is giving a blank sheet and a free pass for genocide to occur, not only on the African continent, but in other parts of the world.
Well, some people are suggesting that the DA is against the move because, you know, they will use the majority in parliament to pass the motion so it could be signed and then gives the government the needed legal backing to formally withdraw from the ICC. What's your take?
Well, my take is that it can go through and can get the procedures right, but it doesn't mean that its actions would make it constitutional. Our constitution enjoins us to adhere to international law and specifically to international human rights law. And I just find it a very, very sad thing that the organization that was at the forefront of dismantling apartheid and of declaring apartheid a crime against humanity should be the same organization that withdraws from an institution whose job it is to prosecute crimes against humanity. So far and so low has the ANC sunk.
James Self is a South African parliamentarian and a leading member of the Opposition Democratic Alliance's legal team. He spoke with me from the capital, Pretoria. Malawian President Peter Mutharika has refuted speculation that he extended stay in the United States following the United Nations General Assembly last month was because he was ill. Mutharika, who arrived in Malawi last Sunday, said during a press conference on Friday in the capital, Lilongwe, that he delayed his return because he was attending to other official duties. For VOA, Lamek Masina reports from the commercial capital, Blantyre.
President Mutharika entered a press conference Friday in a jovial mood. He waved using both hands to supporters of the ruling Democratic Progressive Party in attendance. They outnumbered the more than 30 journalists at the news conference. Upon his return to the country from the United States on Wednesday, however, he was seen greeting people just with his left hand. Speculation was growing that Mutharika's unexplained extended stay in the U.S. was because he was ill. Amid cheers from his supporters, Mutharika told reporters that he is well.
I'm very fine. I'm told by the doctors that my heart, everything else, kidneys, whatever, is about to go over a 30-year-old.
He never grows old.
The 76-year-old Mutharika said he has a minor health problem that limited his use of one hand on his return from the U.S.
Only have one problem, slight one. That's a slight rheumatism, which I've had in the shoulder for many, many years. This time last week, we decided to put some injection. So my arm became numb. So that's why at the airport, I was advised not to shake hands with people.
Rheumatism is a condition, often chronic, that can affect a person's joints and muscles. While stretching his troubled left hand, Mutharika said his hand was about 80% functional and he expected to be fully recovered in about 2 weeks. Mutharika said it would have been illogical for him to leave the U.S. while ill.
I was in America, probably the best country in terms of medical facilities. I have my doctors there. I have my hospitals there. I have my medical insurance there. I mean, I've got to be crazy. Leave the United States very sick to come back here.
Commentators have blamed those close to Mutharika for failing to inform Malawians on the president's state of health. Vincent Kondowe is a political analyst and a social commentator.
Those responsible for giving us the information to the country would have done their duty by saying the truth about the health status of the president. If they personalized the health status of the head of state to an individual level other than a national issue, so one can easily conclude that the people that are surrounding the president are incompetent in the performance of their duties.
Mutharika said he, not those close to him, is to blame for the lack of information on his health.
Don't blame my people. If you want to blame anybody, blame me. All my staff was sent back, and therefore I don't have enough staff to communicate. I did not give them all the details as where I was. So you want to blame me? Blame me.
Mutharika, who was in the U.S. for nearly a month, said he had extended his stay for important meetings. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Former Ghanaian First Lady and opposition National Democratic Party, or NDP, presidential candidate Nana Akunedo Ajimma-Rawlings says she has what it takes to win the upcoming December 7 presidential poll. The Electoral Commission disqualified Ajimma-Rawlings and 12 other presidential candidates for failing to meet requirements. In part one of my interview with her, she says she has the experience to win the presidential vote.
Ghana as a nation is crumbling under the weight of corruption, which I'm sure you are aware of. Bad leadership and poverty caused by the ruling party, and specifically and especially President Mahama's brand of leadership, is really crippling the nation. Now, this country, Ghana, needs leadership that cares for its citizens, a leadership that is bold in its fight against corruption, a leadership that has proven strength in putting Ghana and Ghanaians first. And indeed, I am running for president because I know that I am that leader. And my track record is really in, you know, acting in the best interest all the time, acting in the best interest of my nation. And it's there for all to see. From my work with the women, to the youth, to various development projects, I have always done what is best for Ghana and for Ghanaians.
This is the second time that you've had trouble representing your party, the National Democratic Party, for the presidential elections. Critics say you and your party are to blame for not ensuring due diligence for your documents to meet the Electoral Commission's requirement, as the members of the commission stipulated to all political parties in Ghana. What is your reaction to that?
Not at all. You know, it is clear at this point that the Electoral Commission is being manipulated by the ruling party to fight its wars for them. This is because they know that if my name appears on the ballot paper, they can't win, simply because they have lost the goodwill of the people of Ghana and have no moral authority to lead this nation anymore. They are therefore using the Electoral Commission as their hatchet man. The EC is the custodian of voter records. The voter register is biometric and should not allow for double registration. So if there's any double registration, they are to be blamed, not me. Secondly, the EC should have given our party and myself the opportunity by law for us to correct the said error. This they did not do.
If I may ask you, would you have empirical proof of these allegations you're making? Because the Electoral Commission has flatly rejected this accusation, and that they are trying their maximum best to ensure an equal playing field. And that is why they are applying the law to the latter. What say you about this?
Well, you know, they are not applying the law. When they were asked about the law, which is LICI 94, she said, and some of the commissioners have said, that they have their own internal law which they are using, which means that their internal regulations now supersede the laws of Ghana. It cannot be so, because, you know, my forms actually did meet the regulations. So if they are going to do something, you know, against me, then they should make sure that what they are doing is lawful and does not do anything
that goes against the laws of Ghana.
It appears that your party, or for that matter, you will not participate in this year's general election. The Electoral Commission will be giving the qualified candidate the ability to ballot for their positions on the ballot papers that will be used for the election. What steps are you taking to ensure your disqualification is rescinded and that you will participate, you know, in the upcoming election?
Well, thank you very much. You know, we've taken the issues to our lawyers, and our lawyers have filed in court today against the Electoral Commission. Another party has already put an injunction on them since Friday, so there's no way that they can go ahead with the election. So we are looking at the fact that the EC cannot disqualify me from being part of the voting system in Ghana. So definitely, I think that by the time we finish with this court case, we'll have to put my name back on it and the NDP back on the phone.
Some Ghanaians are saying that you should rather forget about your presidential aspirations or ambitions and support your daughter, who is running for a parliamentary seat. They contend that you have been around power for 19 years, which they said should be enough for you. What's your reaction to such contention from some Ghanaians?
Thank you very much. You know, Mahama has also been around power for many years. The issue is, it's not how many years you have been there, but that the value that you will bring to the Ghanaian leadership. My value that I'll bring to the Ghanaian leadership is about the people, not the leader. As such, what I have done for Ghana is what will show, you know, and they'll have to judge me on that directly.
Nana Kunedu Ajiman Rawlings is a former Ghanaian First Lady and presidential candidate of the opposition National Democratic Party, or NDP. She spoke with me from the capital, Accra. UN Human Rights Monitors have released preliminary findings into violent protests last month in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The UN says at least 53 people were killed, nearly all of them at the hands of security forces. For VOA in the Congolese capital, Kinshasa, Emily Yob has been following efforts by local and international rights investigators to count the dead and has this report.
It's been a month since the daily protest in Kinshasa, but the families of the victims still want answers. It is justice that lifts up the nation, the brother of one of those killed on September 19th told VOA. He says when there is no justice, impunity can make people do a lot of things. He asked VOA not to use his name. He remembers rushing to the scene as soon as he heard his brother had been shot. He says his brother's body had already been taken away to the morgue. He says the family went there, but they denied them entry, claiming an investigation was underway. A week later, he was able to see his brother's body. He said there was a bullet hole in his chest. The government offered his family and families of other victims $5,000 each for funeral costs. The government says 32 people were killed in the violence. Security forces clashed with protesters during an opposition demonstration over delayed elections. Congolese Minister of Interior and Security Evariste Boshab told reporters that the violence was a premeditated and meticulously executed criminal act from the organizers, and that the government would investigate and bring the responsible to justice. The government's report says most of the violence was done by armed protesters. The opposition dispute that claim, as do local and international human rights monitors. In preliminary findings released Friday, UN Rights Monitors say they have confirmed that 4 policemen were killed by demonstrators and another 48 people were killed by state actors. Human Rights Watch has released similar findings. Here is the group's DRC researcher, Ida Sawyer.
As of now, we've confirmed that at least 56 people were killed by the security forces on the 19th, 20th, and 21st, and we've received credible reports of over 30 other victims killed by security forces, and we're still working to verify those reports.
The UN and other researchers say they have faced challenging during their investigations. Georges Kapiamba is a human rights lawyer and president of the Congolese Association for the Right to Justice, or ACAJ. Kapyamba says healthcare personnel were told not to share information with NGO. He says in most clinics, we've noticed the presence of security agents to ensure that these instructions were strictly enforced. Sawyer of Human Rights Watch says the bodies of some missing people have only been found much later after the event.
We've also documented how some of the bodies that were taken away by the security forces were dumped into the Congo River. So these practices seem to be an attempt by the security forces to try to hide the evidence or make it more difficult for families to organize funerals.
The prosecutor of the International Criminal Court wrapped up her visit to the Congo Thursday. Fatou Bensouda expressed serious concern about last month's events and called on all actors to exercise restraint. Emilia Yap for VOA News in Kinshasa.
This year's UN report on TB is a shocker. The reported number of new infections drastically increased over the past year, and doctors know at least 4 million people with TB are not being treated at all. VOA's Carol Pearson has more about this disease, which the UN says is at epidemic levels.
A simple cough can spread a number of deadly diseases, including tuberculosis. Dr. Eric Gooseby is the UN Special Envoy on Tuberculosis. It's his job to get countries mobilized to fight TB.
TB is the threat that can be spread by aerosolized spread, by not a behavior that increases your risk, but by standing behind somebody in line who coughs and infects you with the mycobacterium. No high-risk behavior associated with it other than wrong place at the wrong time.
In a Skype interview, Gooseby explained that TB kills about 5,000 people a day, unnecessarily. Within weeks after exposure to tuberculosis, a person develops a cough, fever, and night sweats, then starts to lose weight. TB usually attacks the lungs, but it can involve any organ in the body. It's a disease that has been around for a long time.
We can diagnose it. We can treat it with effective antimicrobial drugs and cure it in about 90% of cases with the current drugs that are available.
Yet tuberculosis is considered a disease of the past in many countries, and budgets to fight it have been slashed. TB has been vastly undercounted in countries like India, where it's prevalent. Elsewhere, health budgets and medical workers have focused on fighting Zika, Ebola, and other emerging diseases, while TB has been ignored. And that's what has Gooseby concerned.
Our political will has waned, and it has been deprioritized in ministries of health as the urgent emergent disease to respond to. And as a result, we see TB beginning to increase in the number of deaths it's causing. We are now at a death rate of 1.8 million a year, which puts TB as the number one infectious disease killer on the planet.
TB thrives in crowded areas where people lack enough food and good sanitation, which makes them susceptible to other diseases, especially HIV. South Africa has a high rate of HIV and is one of the six countries that account for 60% of the cases of tuberculosis. The others are India, Indonesia, China, Nigeria, and Pakistan. But TB does not stay put. As the world learned from Ebola, it's not just a disease of the poor. Travel took Ebola around the world. It can do the same with TB. That's why Gooseby says he hopes his role as UN Special Envoy will refocus government's attention on tuberculosis. Gooseby says if all countries cooperate, TB can be stopped. The goal is to end the disease by 2030. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Yeah. And right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy. Baby, if you kiss me.
You know I love you, and I'm ready to give you a move. I want to make love to you romantically, or got it well. Baby, I want you after you, now you again. Shaping a me go hustle, after the hustle, now you go again. Oh my baby boo, I love you like. Baby, my boy need it. Where you dance, I see Beyonce. Only you, me, I fancy. Oh, now, see, jide paka, oh, chima, kwana, go, jika, pama. Jide ka, jide paka, ichi, oh, kijika, oh. Baby, if you love me, my life is sweet, oh. Baby, if you kiss me, my life is sweet, oh. I'll go sleep, oh. Me, I go just to watch you, oh, baby. Go massage you, oh, baby. Go let me smell me, oh, man, to man. Haba, I go rock you, oh, baby. Baby, if you love me, just say what you're for, massage you over. But let me see my meal for to buy. Abba, I go rock you over. Baby, la hot. Abba, you deserve a man like me. Give you my heart. Give you everything you need. Baby, G-demo, G-demo, one femo. But just say me to mommy, yo, do mommy, yo, do mommy, yo. Baby, do I love you, love. Baby, my one need is out. The way you dance, I see Beyonce. Only you me a fancy. Oh, now see jide paka, oh, chima kwana go jika pama. Jide ka jide paka, iji oh, kijika oh. Baby, if you love me, my life is sweet oh. Baby, if you kiss me, my life I go sleep oh. Me, I go just say watch you over. Go massage you over. But let me see mommy over to buy. I go rock you over. Baby, if you love me, just watch your back, go massage your back. Follow me, smell me, you want to back. Haba, I go rock your back. Oh, nya si jide kwaka, oji makwa na goji kakwa ma. Njide ka jide kwaka, iji yo, kijika o. Baby, boo, I love you, yash. Be makwa nidisha. Now you be my special package, you must take it home, baby.
Break it, break it, break it, break it. gotta carry me, baby.
Town to Lagos, yeah. Oh, let's get on.
to my party. You and your party. Baby, come away from you. No, they from shy for me. Every other day we dey count money. Every one's day they die for we. Up in the club we high from tree. At every town they go call it for we. I know go shoot by you. No shoot by. I know go shoot shoot you. No shoot shoot. No believe to me. No believe to me. Oh yeah, G job you. Oh yeah, G job. I know go shoot by you. No shoot by. I know go shoot shoot you. No shoot shoot. Oh yeah, G job you. I'm all no believe to me.
Baby oh, baby. Ah, baby oh, baby.
I'm all shoot 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 you.
Baby oh.
Say you know, make I know that you want me.
Sugar boy, yeah. It's G-Wo.
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Thomas Blundet, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a dream doesn't become reality through magic. It takes sweat, hard work, dedication, and determination. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The effect of Hurricane Matthew on Haiti is catastrophic, said U.S. Ambassador Peter Mulrian. And the United States is working closely with the Haitian government to provide vital recovery assistance. Before hurricane season, USAID pre-positioned emergency supplies at warehouses across Haiti that we are now distributing to communities affected by the storm. Additional humanitarian relief supplies from the United States reached Haiti on October 8th with the arrival of a series of cargo plane deliveries over 5 days, carrying more than 480 metric tons of supplies to help an estimated 100,000 people. The United States is deeply saddened by the number of fatalities, said Ambassador Mulrian. I would like to stress the important role that the government of Haiti played to ensure that the number of casualties was not higher. Its warnings and communication efforts urging people to evacuate to safer areas and its provision of shelters saved many lives. Nevertheless, 1.5 million people have reportedly been affected by the hurricane, and 350,000 are in need of immediate assistance. Our general assessment is that priorities for immediate assistance are food, water and sanitation, emergency shelter, and critical health care for communities, particularly in the regions of Grand Anse and Sud. A 50-member disaster assistance response team led by Tim Callahan from USAID's Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance is in Haiti to coordinate U.S. disaster relief efforts with Haitian authorities. At the request of USAID, the U.S. Department of Defense has been delivering critical supplies and humanitarian personnel to areas cut off by the storm through Joint Task Force Matthew. By leveraging forward-deployed forces already in the region, the U.S. military was able to rapidly assist the government of Haiti in responding to this crisis, ensuring life-saving humanitarian assistance reached those in need during the critical first days of the relief effort. This week, as roads along key corridors in Haiti's southwestern peninsula improve and international humanitarian workers bolster their field operations, Joint Task Force Matthew, at the direction of the USAID Disaster Assistance Response Team, began to wind down its operations in Haiti. The government of Haiti is leading the humanitarian response effort, said Ambassador Mulrian, and the United States is committed to supporting Haiti's plan, and we are working in full coordination with the Department of Civil Protection. Our two countries are partners and share a long and deep friendship. The efforts of the United States today and in the coming weeks and months are a natural manifestation of that friendship.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.